Living Transplant is a podcast that takes you behind the scenes at the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital with the goal to educate, inspire, and fuel your passion about transplant. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. I'm thrilled to have you join me for season 5. In this episode of the Living Transplant podcast, I was joined by Loy Miojin, a father, outdoorsman, and all-around very positive person. Loy is living with polycystic kidney disease. We discussed his journey from diagnosis to kidney modality options to the call that came in that changed his life, that there was a living kidney donor ready to donate a kidney to him through the paired exchange program. We're later joined by Christine Bruce, the Senior Director of Laboratory Medicine at UHN. Not only is Christine the director of the program, which is incredibly instrumental in all parts of transplant, but she's also an anonymous kidney donor. After reading an email we sent out about Living Donation Week, Christine made the decision that she would fill out her health history form and wait 6 months to see if she was still passionate about the opportunity to become a donor. And when she decided she was, her path to transplant was unique as she went from a practitioner to a patient. Please enjoy. Welcome back to the Living Transplant podcast. I am thrilled to have Loy with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Candace. Happy to be here.
I'm wondering if you can introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself.
My name is Loy Nguyen, and I just celebrated my 50th birthday in January.
A happy birthday. That's amazing.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. I'm happy to get to 50, and I'm going to be happy to get to 60 and 70 and 80, and you'll see why as we continue on with the conversation. But I'm 50 now. I'm married, wonderful wife, Diana, and I've got two teenage boys, Dylan, who's 14, and Mason, he's 13. So two teenagers, quite a handful. And, you know, in terms of hobbies, it really just centers around my two teenage boys. My oldest plays competitive basketball, so I love watching his practices and his games, obviously. And then my youngest, he's into drama. He likes cooking. I bought him a pasta maker, so he's getting involved with that. I also enjoy going to the gym on an almost daily basis because I can now. We'll get into that later on. And also I like the outdoors. So, you know, if you think about like canoeing, camping, and hiking, we'll get into more of that. But I love that kind of activity too. That's a bit about me.
Incredible. You alluded a little bit to it there. If you're comfortable, I'm wondering if you can take us back a little bit. We're going to talk today about your journey with kidney disease and dialysis and transplant. And so I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about your diagnosis and what that was like.
Yeah. So I have polycystic kidney disease, probably born with it, likely, and possibly even genetic. My sister has it as well, and probably some other members that I'm not even sure of have it as well. So essentially, the function of my kidney is being hindered by these cysts or these bubbles that are developing on my kidney. And over time, it has decreased my function. Somewhere in my 30s, I was starting to get physicals completed with my family doctor, annual physicals. And, you know, that required blood, urine tests. And one of the results that came back with the blood test was my creatinine was quite elevated. And my family doctor raised some concern and told me a little bit about that. And then the following year, we did the physical and same thing, elevated, and now started to get beyond the sort of normal range. And it was time to get referred to a nephrologist. Probably around 10 years being monitored by a nephrologist. I would see a nephrologist once or twice a year. And just tried some different things with my diet to try to slow down my kidney function. There were no real medications that I was eligible for or any treatment options per se. So every single time I got an update from the nephrologist, like, oh, your kidney function is 70%. I would just be like, okay, like I didn't have any symptoms. And so it was just a kind of a matter of fact. Kind of an update because I had no symptoms. And in my mind, I was just hoping, I hope it just plateaus. If it's at 70, I hope it just stays at 70. But every year it would decrease. So from 70 to 65 to 60, there definitely was a trend over those 10 years. It declined. And It declined to somewhere around, I want to say 15 to 20. And then I was referred to a multi-care kidney clinic at the Toronto General Hospital. And that's a program, I want to say. It's a program basically that allows kidney patients, when they come in for a checkup, they don't only see the nephrologist, they get to see, or they get a dedicated social worker, dedicated kidney nurse. You talk to a pharmacist and a dietitian. So there's all of these professionals all there to help you with whatever needs you need. And so it's a very specialized type of care. I was so lucky to have the team that I had there, and they were, the kidney nurse was a humongous advocate for me in trying to get a preemptive transplant. So this leads into a different discussion about trying to find a donor and using social media to try to find a donor. I wasn't successful in finding my own donor, and I had to then decide on the modality of treatment, dialysis. So whether it's going to be hemodialysis, maybe in the clinic or maybe at home, or peritoneal dialysis. Well, it was going to be at home most likely for that one. You know, my kidney function was around 12% when I got into the multi-care kidney clinic. And so when the kidney nurse says, okay, you know, you've got to make a decision. And so I was going to the hemodialysis clinic to see what the environment was like. I was going to the PD clinic to see what the environment was like, what the machines were being used. Holy smokes, I couldn't make a decision. It was so difficult. I was really, there's a term, paralysis of analysis, and I was just in it. I was consulting with my wife and said, hey, you know, what do you think? She didn't know, obviously. We would talk to some medical professionals who are just trying to do their best to provide the information that I needed, but they are not kidney patients, so I wasn't getting any support from there. And I was also very reluctant to talk to other kidney patients for some reason. Yeah, I remember my social worker saying, because I was having consult sessions with her, and you know, it was just quite emotional. It's a lot going on, a lot of information. It's extremely overwhelming when you're facing dialysis and you're trying to make a decision, and there's a lot going on. And so she said, you know, you might find find it useful to join or to participate in some peer support, either one-on-one or maybe through a group, and you could be with other, you could talk to other kidney patients. And my mind at that time was just, it was just like a gridlock. I couldn't decide. That's something I wanted. I think I did end up saying, okay, have someone call me. And program coordinator at the Kidney Foundation called me. I mistakenly thought she wasn't a kidney patient. I thought she was like a lot of the other medical professionals that I had interacted with. And I had interacted with so many medical professionals. I've already talked about, you know, the multi-care kidney clinic that had the pharmacist, nurse, dietitian, nephrologist. No one's ever had kidney disease. And so when the program coordinator at the Kidney Foundation called me, I just thought she was another voice, another person from that kind of context. And needless to say, I also was not ready for that kind of support. I was just thinking about other things, so emotional. And so that call went pretty quick, and I probably was maybe just dismissive or aloof or just not really receptive at that time.
And at this time, when you're facing all of those thoughts about what kind of dialysis, and not even what kind of dialysis, but the fact that you're going to do dialysis, yes, we have to make a decision about what kind we're going to do as patients, but we also have to reconcile the fact that this is now the life that we're stepping into, right? That it's no longer something we can ignore and push off. It's time that that starts. And that is a huge change. And having a family, how old were your kids when you were going through this?
It was about 5 years ago. So yeah, they were like 8 and 9. They were quite young. You know, again, that's another conversation, but I tried to do my best to not change any of their routines, not have my behavior be of any change. as best as possible, because some kids don't react the best with change, and my youngest does not react well with change. And so I tried to just keep things shielded in terms of any issues that I was going through. I kept them sort of, I was masking, for lack of a better word.
It's interesting when you become a parent, that's one of the first things that we always do, right? Is you put your kids first and you think about what their situation is. Even recently, I had a hospital stay, and that was the only thing that was on my mind. I was like, yes, please tell me how my kidney's doing, but what's going on with my daughter at home? Is she okay? How's she going to bed without all of those things? You think about them first. And that must have been tough to think, how is this going to impact these very active boys' lives?
Yeah, it was challenging. I did move into more of a self-care, self-determination, self-drive type of, I guess, mindset. But to finish off the modality piece, I pined over the decision for at least a month. It was quite a long time. I think about it right now. The PD nurse, we met a PD nurse at the clinic, and there was something that she said to me and my wife. She said, listen, if you start PD, it is gentler, and you still can, I don't know how she phrased it, but she said you'll still be able to utilize, what remaining function, kidney function you have. And I guess just the combination of those words and the fact that I was just trying to find almost any reason not to do hemo. I mean, the needles, the blood, it just was a concept that was, I just wasn't ready for that. And so I was just trying to find enough of a justification to go on to PD dialysis. But all the research I did was telling me that all roads lead to hemodialysis. Like people that start on PD go to hemo. Some people are not eligible to go to PD and they have to do hemo. It just felt like I'm going to eventually go to hemo. Why don't I just do hemo? And then my fear of the needles and blood would always stop me from wanting to plunge into that. Although now looking back, many years later, I could have done well with hemo. There's absolutely no reason why I couldn't have done well. But I ended up doing PD. That was the journey that I went on. And so I had to get my PD catheter inserted. So it's a plastic tube that goes in my stomach. And on one end is the connector. And liquid goes into my stomach cavity. And then through, osmosis, it pulls all of the minerals that my kidneys cannot pull from my body. So phosphorus, potassium, two of the biggest ones, and creatinine as well, but more phosphorus and potassium. Yeah, so I got the surgery. It was a rough surgery for me. I had waited as long as I could to get that surgery and to decide to go on dialysis. And because I waited as long as I could, I had just so much built up toxins in my body. My kidney function was probably down to close to 10%. And going through that surgery for that catheter insertion, it was rough recovery. It took me a good 2 weeks to recover. Even the day of, I remember thinking, oh, I'll just be able to walk out of the hospital because it's day surgery.
Right.
I don't realize how my body's going to react to this surgery. I mean, it's fighting a tough fight internally, and I don't realize that. It's making so many adjustments just so I can carry on normally. Leaving that surgery, and I'm in the recovery room. I did not feel well. I felt so nauseous. I was telling my wife, I need to stay here for the night. I can't move. I'm so not. And she's like, they're closing in an hour. We got to leave.
And
they're trying to turn off the lights. And I'm like, no, honey, I'm not feeling well. She's like, no, we need to go. You cannot stay and you cannot be admitted. She went and got a wheelchair. I ended up sitting. She took me to the car and I passed out on the ride home. About 2 weeks it took me to recover. And then training occurred. I did home PD dialysis, so you get a shipment of medical supplies. So the liquid that you need, along with all of the bandages and tape, everything. I had a corner of medical supplies. And then once I started dialysis, I started to feel better.
Good.
The blood was finally being cleaned. Yeah, I started to think about routine in life and started booking my first camping trip for the summer. And then reached back out to the Kidney Foundation and talked to the program coordinator and started my journey with peer support from there. And it's been fantastic. And I still do peer support to this day. Dialysis, PD dialysis lasted for about 2.5 years. So 2020, 2021, just a little bit of 2022. And then I got the call that everyone talks about, you know, the call.
And the call, yes.
Yeah, I got the call a few other times, but I was the backup. And okay. This time I was the recipient, and they had a living donor.
Yeah.
Somehow I got matched with a living donor. And so I got the call on, I think it was a Thursday, and they said that they had a kidney for me and that you gotta run some tests, but the surgery wouldn't be until the following Friday, which that's different, because usually I gotta get in the hospital right away. And they said, no, it's not till Friday. It's a living donor. And I said, a living donor. And so I had about a week to get my personal affairs in order. You know, when I think back about that period of the call and the actual surgery, I was so excited.
Mm-hmm. What did that feel like when you picked up the phone and they said, it's you, like you're the one who's going to get this living donor kidney?
Yeah, I was stunned and surprised, you know, because you can get calls like this and you're just the backup. So you end up, I wouldn't say the novelty of it wears off. I'm not going to use those specific words, but you can get an understanding of what to expect. And so when the call comes in, this is the fifth time they've called me, and I'm thinking, I'll just be another backup. This is I'm getting closer and closer, but this is the actual call. So I'm stunned. It goes almost into robotic, where I got to pack my overnight bags as I did before. You know, it starts to be very task oriented, and I'm not feeling as much, but I'm kind of stunned. And then after a day or two, I start getting excited about, oh my God, like I won't have to do dialysis. The cramps, the fatigue, I'm hoping that goes away, because those are the biggest issues I faced. I can spend more time with my family. Oh my goodness. Like I do 50, 60 plus hours of dialysis, and that can all, you know, go away with this treatment. It is a treatment when you get a transplant, and it's a great treatment option. Yeah, so I was feeling so thankful, grateful, and excited. The surgery itself, I was not anxious about that at all. I just felt so excited about what's to come. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? How did your family feel when you got off that call? What did you say to them? What was that like?
Yeah, it you know, my kids were still pretty young, and so they didn't know what to expect, my kids. But my wife, she works in healthcare, and so she knew that, like, this is huge. You know, like I said, we had other calls, and I was the backup, and this being, and especially being a living donor, it's extremely unusual in that kind of situation. You normally need to have your own donor to kind of get into like a pair exchange type of program. Yeah, my wife was excited. And obviously, you know, supportive throughout my whole kidney journey, and still very supportive. I mean, I'm on this journey for life. We're on this journey for life, this kidney journey. It doesn't really end. We're either going to be on dialysis or transplanted. And I think that's something that I've come to realize and appreciate a lot more now that I'm transplanted and I've seen the full cycle.
I think that was more of a difficulty and a milestone for me to realize that this is not a one-off treatment, that now I have a transplant and I'm just done for life and that's great and off we go. That living with a chronic illness means that at any time in our journeys, we may need a different kind of treatment, right? And so every time I look at those pills, it's a thank you, tiny little pills. Some of you I loathe because of what you do, but thank you to those pills, because without them, then we're back on dialysis. And now I have an interesting question for you. Since you had PKD, I was wondering, did they take your polycystic kidneys out or did they leave them in?
No, they left them in.
Okay.
And the way that they explained it to me was it's because they're not problematic. They didn't.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, when I was seeing the nephrologist for about 10 years and the function was going down, I wasn't having any symptoms. I think the only thing that was troubling to see was sometimes the cysts would rupture, and I would pee blood. So there wouldn't be any pain. There would just be, I'd be urinating red liquid. And it's so startling and concerning.
Yeah, that's scary.
You know, it happened one time. I saw the nephrologist, and he said, oh, well, that's pretty normal. You probably had a burst. We'll do some tests, double check. But like I said, I didn't have any pain even from that kind of episode. It happened only two or three times. They were quite large. We're talking about 30 centimeters. So remember those rulers that we used to use in school?
Yes.
Each side was the length of a ruler, 30 centimeters. Apparently, removing one of them, you're taking an organ out. So it's a big, big surgery. So the consideration made to keep them in is not without any light sort of thought. And I'm happy that they did keep them in there because, like I said, I didn't have any issues with them. And more so now that I'm almost 3 years post-transplant, they have actually shrunken. They're down to, one is at 22 centimeters and one is 20 centimeters.
Wild.
And so that's a nice surprise. Seeing a reduction. It's not the same for everybody. Everyone's kidney journey is different. Everyone's polycystic kidney disease is different. But for me, luckily, those native kidneys did shrink.
Going back to the transplant, thinking about that whole wild journey of you get the call and then you're waiting to go in and you finally get to the hospital. What was that process like of saying goodbye to your wife and your kids and hoping that when you wake up, you have a healthy, new, fresh little kidney in there?
I couldn't keep a thought in my mind. I was so excited. I had a kidney friend. I'm going to say his name, Joseph. Joe. I met him when I was just about to start dialysis, and I knew I wanted to be his friend. When I got the call, I told him after I shared it with my wife, and he said, oh, hey, you know what? Your surgery, I'm going to be in the hospital. I got some other things going on, but let me know if we can just touch base. And I was like, oh yeah, Joe, I want to hang out with you and we'll just hang out. And so after saying goodbye to my kids and my wife, I checked in and I went to go to my room and then I went to go see Joe, and we just chit chatted. And, I wasn't nervous, but it just brought me right down to, hey, I'm just seeing a friend that I'm just hanging out with a friend. And he was there for me even after the transplant, and my wife was there as well. So I had a really beautiful experience just before transplant and even after transplant in terms of support. This is, in 2022. So there was still some COVID measures as it relates to, visitors and things like that. So having, support was a bit of a luxury there.
Yeah. Wow. And how amazing that is to have somebody to connect like that and center you right before going into likely the biggest surgery of your life, right? To be going in thinking positive things and feeling calm. And
it was amazing. Joe is also a kidney patient. He's transplanted now, but back then he wasn't transplanted when I was getting transplanted. And there definitely was a bit of survivor's guilt after my transplant because he hadn't been transplanted yet. I know that's another issue, another topic, but the survivor's guilt was very hard. It hit me really, really hard for a few months after transplant. It's tough when you want the best of people. But I had a lot of support during my transplant process.
We do, once you're part of this community, you end up meeting a lot more people, right? I was with you there. One of my close friends, his dad was on dialysis while I was as well. And unfortunately, he passed away before his wife was finished her testing. Going through that was... I didn't expect that would have been part of my journey, the survivor's guilt. I really did think you get your kidney and with your kidney, you get all of the happiness that you expect and that's it. It's just going to be joy and there's no other emotions that will come with it. And then having that tidal wave of all of the things, I don't think I was really prepped for the anger, the sadness, the grief, the guilt, everything that comes with it and thinking, why me, but not in a... not a why me as in pity why me, but a why me, like, why did I get chosen to have this versus other people who are waiting?
You know, there's still some lingering feelings, and it's still raw. Certain parts of my journey are still very, very raw, as you can see. But I sought support from my other kidney friends, and through the Kidney Foundation, the peer support one-on-one, and through group peer support, I was able to get a lot of insight from others. I feel better about the situation. Yeah, it was a difficult thing and definitely a surprise.
And I think I might say it on every podcast, but it's not a family or a community that I would hope somebody would be a part of. But once you're in it, it is just filled with so many remarkable people and such an incredible family and community to be part of the kidney crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have my own kidney crew. I'm going to see them this Friday. I can't wait to see them this Friday. We're going to hopefully have some pizza in the St. Catharines area. Yeah, so there's five of us in total, and I met them all, you know, through the Kidney Foundation. We all have kidney disease. We're all on different kidney journeys, but, you know, despite all of that, you know, we're all friends, and we're really close with each other.
Yeah, and being able to sit with somebody and saying something and knowing that you don't have to explain it, there's such power in that for somebody to nod and say, oh, yeah, but they actually do understand. It's not just a sympathy, okay? It's amazing to have that.
I didn't expect it, that I would carve out a close friend group with the kidney community, but I think it's something that's natural and that's available for people if they want to be a part of something like the kidney community, whether that's social media or peer support, whatever it is. There's different ways to get support. And I think it's vital for anybody that's on their kidney journey to get some sort of support, however that looks like for them.
And it's interesting when you said prior, when you talked to the program coordinator, that you weren't really in that space yet to have that. And I think that's important too, of knowing ourselves and when that would be beneficial. I was like you too, at the beginning of dialysis, I said, I don't want to talk to anybody else. I don't want this to be part of my life. I'm going to move on and act like I'll do my treatment, move on, and that's it. And it wasn't until I started to actually get that support that I realized, oh yeah, I need this. And not only do I need it just for this moment, but it's a lifelong thing with people who have been there before, that it just makes all the difference in the support that you can get from those people. So if you're listening, what Loy and I are saying is reach out to your kidney community, because they know so much and they've been through it, and they can just be a listening ear that understands.
As someone said, a previous guest on your podcast, Craig Lindsay, I remember years ago when I watched his kidney journey, I'm like 5 years ago, I was watching YouTube videos of people going through their kidney journey. Craig was one of them. And I remember he would say things like, you can manage this on your own, but you don't have to. It was a phrase, something like that. And that always, the way that sounded to me, it felt like I don't have to be alone or do this alone. I can if I want to, if I felt like that, but I don't have to. And it just felt so inviting.
You've been on such a journey from an early diagnosis until post-transplant. And as we said, it doesn't stop just because we're transplanted. It's just a different part of our journey. How has your diagnosis and dialysis and transplant life changed your perspective, or has it changed your perspective on life at all?
Yeah, it absolutely has. I mean, yeah. I don't think about the future as much as I used to.
Mm.
And that's for better or for worse. But I think of it like from the perspective of just enjoying the present,
mm.
right? When I was on dialysis, I did a lot of outdoor camping, and I documented it. So I have videos of me doing dialysis in the woods. Like I'm right next to the lake, right? And the dialysis bag is hanging on a tree branch.
Tree.
And I have many videos of this.
You'll and have when to I send watch, them to us.
Yeah, when I watch them now, it's extremely surreal. It is mm-hmm. so surreal to see that man doing dialysis on that tree branch by the mm-hmm. water. And so whatever stage I was in, I just tried to make the best out of it. You know, I'm on dialysis, I'm going to do the best that I can. And back then I wanted to do a lot of outdoor camping because I wasn't sure if I would be able to get a kidney. I wasn't like, nothing's guaranteed in the future. I was hopeful that I was going to get a kidney, but anything can happen. I don't want to take it for granted. There's plenty of people there that are not eligible to be transplanted. So now that I am transplanted, I spend a lot of time with my family. I didn't even go camping last year. So, you know, things are just different. I may go camping this year, but I just think about the present and be appreciative of what I have, you know, loving family, I'm productive, and I'm able to do a lot more now. And I just focus on that. And that's really what's been the biggest difference.
That's amazing. Often when I speak to people who have had anonymous donors, many have never talked to them or never communicated with them. And I'm wondering if you could say something to that living donor, if there would be something you would want to tell them.
I mean, you know, I would give them a big hug. That's the first thing. A long hug, probably. A good cry right after that, most likely, at the same time. And then I would just tell them, you know, thank you. And then I would share with them the kind of impact that, you know, their gift has given me. I would show them maybe a couple of my son's basketball games that I've attended and practices. I would show them the poem my youngest did on stage. And it's just, you know, mesmerizing to see him up there doing his thing. I would show them some of the activities that I've been able to be involved in. You know, right after my transplant, I did a 10-kilometer walk, the Sporting Life walk. And that was only a month after getting that kidney, which just shows you how advanced we are with transplantation, matching processes, everything around that. I would show them a lot of my life after transplant, just to show them the impact that decision has made in my life. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Now, I know you do a lot of talking with people who are waiting and within those peer groups. I'm wondering if you have any advice for people who are waiting for an organ, or even people who are post-transplant recipients, families, donors, just our general community, if you have a message or some advice for them.
For people who are waiting, keep doing the things you love. Don't let dialysis, you know, it's a treatment, and there's certainly a lot of complexity around that treatment, whatever dialysis modality that you pick. But keep doing the things you love. You know, for me, it was camping. So when I started dialysis, I didn't think about camping right away. But once I got my treatments going and I got into my routine, yeah, and then I started thinking about camping right away. And I thought, well, how could I go camping? So I started car camping. And then once I didn't have any issues with car camping and doing my dialysis in the car, I started thinking, well, what if I go, you know, canoe camping? And so I started paddling, know, to campsites from the parking lot that's on the side of the lake. And then I said, well, could I do some portaging, you know? And so I did one canoe trip that involved some short portages.
Wow.
That was brutal.
Yes.
And I only did the one, but like I said, you can still do amazing things while you're on dialysis, and you can, you know, more importantly, continue to do the things you love, even if it's in a modified way. For people that are on their transplant, I would say if you can, and this would apply to anybody on their kidney journey. You know, if you're comfortable, share your journey. Your journey and everyone's journey is unique. I remember when I was watching YouTube videos, this is just before dialysis, I was watching a lot of YouTube videos of people going through their kidney journey. I remember I didn't see anybody that was really into the outdoors or that was camping or you know, things that I was actively doing back then. So now I'm always trying to get that image and that video or that kind of story out that, you know, you can do things that you still love. For me, it was camping. And so I shared that through the Kidney Foundation that, you know, dialysis through the woods. There's pictures of me doing it. I have TikTok videos of me doing dialysis in the woods. And so I just want to make it available for people to kind of understand that, yes, this is going to be potentially a challenging time, but it can also be a time where you can still do the things that you love.
Thank you so much for sharing your journey today and for letting us into that part of your life and for giving people listening some hope as well. One foot in front of the other one and enjoy the moment that we're in. Thank you so much, Loy.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Candace. Really
appreciate
enjoyed this.
It. Yes, it's been lovely. And I see that our amazing Christine is in the waiting room. So I'm going to let her in as well for us. It is my pleasure to have Christine, who is the Senior Director of Laboratory Medicine here at UHN. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
I'm wondering if you can introduce yourself to our listeners, tell them a little bit about who you are and maybe what an average day looks like in your role, if there is one.
Oh, yeah. Happy to do that, I think. I was sort of ruminating on what does a normal day in Christine Bruce's work life look like. But as you said, so I'm Christine Bruce. I'm the Senior Director for Lab Medicine here at UHN, which covers the lab program across all of the UHN campuses out to our West Park facility, Toronto Western, Toronto General, Princess Margaret Hospital, the Toronto Rehab sites, as well as any of the partner locations that the UHN Lab Medicine program supports, which represents 34 hospitals across Northern Ontario. And so we have a tremendous amount of influence in that region in order to keep their lab operations stable and open, to continue to allow those hospitals to provide care closer to home and not rely on sending patients to the south using really costly transport mechanisms and the like. So that's been work that UHN has done for years and years and years, but it's much more expanded since moving out of the COVID phase of our careers.
Right.
So it's a pretty big mantle of influence and decision making, and just it does require an abundance of thoughtfulness to really figure out. So it's a very cool job to have. And it's not an amount of responsibility that I take lightly at all. And so an average day in the life, I mean, the program that I lead here is, we have numerous disciplines within the lab medicine programs. There's eight. And so that would be anything from biochemistry to microbiology to molecular genetics. We have 703 employees that may need something along the way. And those staff are what I just basket as lab professionals. So there's a lot of different professionals that all collaborate within LMP to ensure that we're providing the very best care. So it's a cool place to be. So you've got all these people across a broad number of campus sites. We operate 24/7, 365 in a high acuity quaternary care level institution, but then support all the way down to frontline community hospital and sort of medical aid centers in the remote Indigenous North. And so I don't know what the day is going to be like. I really don't, but I come in hoping that there's very little to panic about when I come in, check in with my managers and get ready for our huddle. And so we really focus on what are the issues around safety that we have to worry about at both an employee and a patient level, and what do we need to deal with right away? What do we need to share with the rest of the organization that they need to know? The operations of the day and making sure that the team have everything they need to deliver best patient care. No matter what that need is, whether it's a CBC or a very complicated genetics panel to be tested or any pathology to be run and reviewed by our pathologist team, it could really be anything. But I love that it is totally unpredictable at the end of the day. Like, I could be dealing with anything, and that's kind of cool.
And so for our purposes, hearing you list all of these amazing things, how is the work in laboratory medicine, how is it connected to transplant?
What is probably not known by many, and perhaps not even known by lots of people in my program, is that the lab medicine program is the, like all of the aspects of the lab medicine program between genetics and chemistry, all the ones I listed before, it is the transplant program is the only one touched by every phase of my department. So, you know, if you're an eMERGE patient, you're probably going to be largely served by the core lab where you need rapid results really quickly so that physicians can make decisions. If you're a cancer patient, unfortunately, you're probably going to lean into my pathology program more because we need the pathology for the diagnosis. But to do a transplant, every single team I have has to contribute to that. And that's because the HLA team is so unique, that histocompatibility team, their job is to determine if there's compatibility between the donor and the recipient. And that doesn't happen in any other program in the hospital. So it's the one time that I can say everybody works together to make sure that this particular medical service can happen well. And that is really, really awesome to be able to say. And it's a nice unifying feature for the whole LMP team. Because as you can imagine, when you're within a group of 700 plus people, it's hard to be unified, it's hard to be unique. Like when it's a transplant, we've all got to link up in order for it to be successful, right through to the recovery of both the donor and the recipient, even like the ongoing monitoring to make sure that the the recipient's doing well, to make sure that the donor is still doing well. It carries on. It is just, it's so neat to be able to say that to anybody who wants to know. It's like, finally, you know, everyone does something because HLA can be part of this. I love that.
That's amazing. For my personal journey going through it, I was diagnosed with kidney disease when I was 24 and we didn't know what the cause was. And it took a good 12 years before we found out through genetic testing that mm-hmm. I was missing a gene when mm-hmm. I was born, which caused my kidneys to fail and caused some eye problems. But I was talking to my direct contact with the genetic testing and I said, "Do you just love your job? It seems very cool that it's almost like a puzzle that you guys are looking into yeah. and trying to discover new things and you're getting all of these results. And it almost seems like detective work." And she said, "Yeah, I love yeah. my job. It's fascinating and amazing. It's yeah. so cool, the work that you all do."
And it's really neat as a lab technologist. I mean, there are numerous types of lab technologists out there. There's a general lab technologist that is proficient in 5 lab disciplines. And then we have the very unique molecular genetics technologists or cancer cytogenetics technologists. And they have very specific skill sets and very specific baskets of knowledge and a foundation in everywhere else. But mm-hmm. when you enter the field of lab medicine, you can practice everywhere, but you usually migrate to one or the other, right? I mean, if you've got folks who really like the high volume intensity of working in the core lab where I need the result in 20 minutes kind of right. thing, versus the folks who want to, you know, literally wade through reams and reams of genetic data looking for the variant that you needed to know you had,
yes.
Or the mutation that you had or the deletion that you had to help really appreciate what diagnosis you need. Mm-hmm. You go in one way or the other. And that's why you end up so passionate about the world you're in, is because it is a space that is just so interesting to you that you stay there and you continue right. to practice there and grow there and evolve there. Yeah, you gotta love it. You've got to love it.
Yes. How did you make that decision that that's what you were gonna go into?
When I was little.
Really?
When I was little, I had said to myself, I would like to be a ballerina. And I held on to the ballerina dream well into my high school years, of course, never having done ballet. Okay, let's be
right. Yes.
I do not have the center of gravity to be a proficient ballerina. I'm entirely too short, slightly stout. So not a match. And I said, well, okay, well, the ballerina dream is not going to happen. So I need right. to pay bills. And I really like doing science experiments. It's silly. I mean, everybody that has gone through the exercise of trying to pick a meaningful career and they put a lot of thought into it and picking the right school. And I mean, I don't mm-hmm. mean to disparage that in any way at all, but I sat in the guidance office of my high school back when there was no internet and it was paper-based. Right. All the catalogs were there. And I was just flipping and I said, I want to go to college because I want to work. And I was flipping through the St. Lawrence College program guide and I came upon medical laboratory technology. And there was a list of all the things that you would learn in this program. And it was chemistry that I knew about and biology and all those classic medically things. Like, well, I like the sound of that. It sounds like I'm going to be doing science experiments. And then there was this thing called phlebotomy. I'm like, I don't know what that is. It's there. I'm gonna have to do it once. Okay, I'm gonna learn what that is when I get there. I don't know if I knew that would be sticking needles in my classmates that I would have signed on so quickly. But you know, I became very good at it and eventually taught it after that. So it wasn't that wow. big of a deal. And then it was the only college I applied to. I was accepted. I went, I learned, I loved it. And then I immediately jumped into the industry and have continued to very quickly move through it in terms of taking on additional accountability, having more breadth of influence, that kind of thing. And I've navigated in this very particular focused lab space through both the community sector, through the private, like the private community sector, into the public sector in acute care and community care, through the ministry. I've done work at public health. I've done work with the educators and with the regulators and with the certification bodies and with accreditation. So I understand the industry deeply. And I think that's why I like it so much, is because I understand everything about it. There's very little nuance that would take me by surprise. And so I trust it because I get how all the parts move together. I just trust being in this space. I trust myself in this space, but that has made me a bit of a, albeit a diverse one trick pony. I am a bit of a one trick pony in that I do other things? Sure. But I really love lab medicine. And so I can't imagine a career that doesn't have that as part of it.
I love the passion. It's incredible.
But it's a lot of, like not always pretty work, and it's a high volume. There are days when it is just a factory of unwell, and it's hard to stay super motivated and enthusiastic about things. And then sometimes you get to be part of something like a transplant, or like maybe someone who's receiving an organ and is not doing particularly well, and we have to jump in from a transfusion perspective and provide just endless amounts of blood product just to help that patient stay alive. And then when it's over, 28 hours later, and the patient made it. And the frontline team shares that with the lab, right? They share it because we were all involved in it together, and it's just such an overwhelming, oh, thank goodness. That's when you're reminded, but that this isn't a factory, and it's not, I mean, it's a high volume institution, but you remind yourself that every one of those individual tests that you ran, as much as it was just a number as it was going through, it has a very material impact somewhere in this hospital or within this community.
That's beautiful. I love the idea of thinking of our diagnosis as patients to post-transplant, and having that whole team be part of every step of the way and cheering you on, and they're all happy when you do succeed. It's a very nice feeling to know that's happening behind the scenes, that the people who care are really working hard for us.
Very, very hard. Yeah. Yeah. And they don't take it lightly. Right. I mean, the fuck's going to be the grumpy, like, your job's not great, or, the microwave's broken, or like whatever cloud's going to be on your day. But when the rubber hits the road, like the group is right on point and know exactly what they're doing and why. And it is quite something to behold the choreography of this whole team doing what they do really, really well.
Now, thinking about that team, you mentioned how instrumental your team is with transplant. Going to the personal side of things, today we're not just talking about your role in lab medicine, but when I read your story, it brought me to tears right away, not just because I'm a recipient, but I actually send the email about Living Donation Week every year.
Oh, you send it. You're on the other side.
So I'm on the other side. So for listeners, every year I send an email to all of our staff to let them know that Living Donation Week is coming up. And I put information about Living Donation. I put information about our events that we're doing, and try to just let everybody know what's going on. And my hope is that people open it and that they read it. But I definitely never imagined the spark that would come from that email. So can you tell us a little bit about the email that you received and what your outcome was in thinking about that email?
Yeah, sure. I always read the weekly emails from the CEO or the broader team UHN style emails, because there might be something in there that my team needs. And so I read them. So when I read it, and like, it's Living Organ Donor Month, right? I guess I didn't realize that there was a week dedicated to living organ donor or donations specifically is this week identified in September. And so when it came in, I read it. I'm like, why aren't more people doing this? And what kind of an odyssey does one go on in order to become a donor? I said, well, I'm a relatively healthy person. Why wouldn't I do that? Right. If I talk about, trying to reduce the costs of people that are on chronic dialysis, if I talk about the kind of stuff, is there something different that I could do? Just as much as it's an incremental thing, it's one donation, it's one patient, it's one thing, but it is, to me, it is one person perhaps not on dialysis anymore, it's one person not waiting, it's one life changed. Is there a thing I can do as a public person versus as a lab person to influence how this space is? It even as incremental as it is, it's like, handing the person on the street the $5 or the sandwich, right? Is there a thing I can do? And it does interest me. Like, I love the idea of plugging in parts to keep everybody going, right? I love that we can do that. And so I was like, well, you're supposed to just fill in a form, right? It's how hard is it? And you don't have to necessarily go through. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's see what this does. Let's see, as a new person at UHN, and I'm part of team UHN, and this is a thing that UHN is asking us to think about, why wouldn't I think about it? Filled it all out. I sent it in, not knowing which type I would be asked to do. I mean, I think I had a choice of, I could signal interest in either liver or kidney at the time. And so I said, well, I'm up for either, whoever needs the piece of me the most, I guess. Let's get in the process and see what happens. I was about to fax it, and I was like, let's just make sure. Because once you're in, knowing myself as I do, once I'm in, and if the process starts to run really fast, I'm not going to want to back out. And I'm not going to want to feel regret either. And I'm not going to want to create anxiety within my family and my social circle. So I said, let's just see if I am as passionate about this in 6 months. And so I put a little reminder in my calendar to remind me to look at the packet on my desk. But the packet that I filled out, hand filled it out, it was like 20 plus pages. Still, we haven't evolved to a digital form, right? I'm like, this is fabulous. And so I'm filling it all out. So it's sitting on my desk and it's there. I got a little binder clip over it so it doesn't get all, you know, messed up. And the world that I described at the beginning of this podcast just keeps on turning, right? Every day there's stuff flying on my desk, and that little pack of paper is still there. I've cleaned my office, I've moved papers, I've filed papers, but that packet has always remained. And then the thing pops up on my computer to say, are you going to send that form today? And I was like, oh yeah, I got to look at the form. And so then I went through it and read it all again. And I went online and read the information for the kidney pair donation program that they reference in the package, just to be sure I understood. And then I said, yeah, let's just do this. I care about it. I think it's important to set an example. And it's really, when you think about CBS in there, it's in you to give. It's in me to give. I've got one. Why don't I see if this could help somebody? And so I faxed it. And I think within 2 weeks, I received a response from the kidney donation team. And then the process began. And it was a long process of checking and testing. And I didn't have an appreciation for that. I would say that the what you need to do to be evaluated as a laboratorian, 100% the right thing to do. So it had started, all the orders, all of the exercises that need to happen to evaluate you as a donor began. And I just complied. I'm like, okay, well, I guess this is the next step, and let's see what we learn. Knowing all along that if we learned something not great, right? Let's say we learned that I had some issue, that I knew that UHN was also going to manage the situation. It wasn't going to be if we see a strange something or other on your kidney, you better go to your physician. Like, well, no, that was never going to happen. So I never really felt concerned, but I always felt anxiety that this might be the day I don't get to participate again, right? This might be the day that I get punted out. And so I always felt that, oh, what if it doesn't work today, right? What if, because every milestone, my coordinator would say, okay, everything looks great. We're going to move on to imaging, right. Move on to the mental health check or whatever. I'm like, what if today's the day I didn't pass? Got way more intense as I moved along the process. Like the closer I got to the time was like, yeah. Oh, do not do something stupid, Christine, to compromise this patient, right? Don't, right. Don't get an infection. Don't contract COVID, like whatever. Don't do it. And so there's just a whole different kind of accountability.
And how long did that process take for you from submitting your application to finding out that, yes, you are accepted?
But yes, I was accepted. So it probably took a bit longer than it should have. And so I started the process in March of 2023. So that was when the first kind of go get your blood work done thing happened, and everything was motoring along great. And then we did the imaging, and there was a little bit of a nodule was noted on one of my adrenal glands, completely, you know, innocuous, but because of the why we're testing, we want to be very, very sure that this isn't anything. And so the wait to have a specialist evaluate why that was there. So I had to see some endocrine folks here at UHN just to evaluate what that was or wasn't. And so that meant that there was some additional blood work and urine testing to be done. Completely fine. But what I didn't want, I said, okay, if letting the, because I mean, getting a specialist in the grand scheme of medicine is not a tomorrow thing, unless you're particularly unwell. So I was actually happy that it didn't happen fast.
Right, yes.
But the specialist took a little bit to get, as it should, because he's special and he's seeing lots of people that are unwell. I'm not unwell. Right. I said, you know, if we hail him to look at me right now, when would I potentially mm-hmm. get into the transplant pipe? Like, do we have to expedite this, or can I just follow the process and not be, you know, quote unquote special? Just let the process happen. I'm like, okay, yes. Great. Cause I don't want to be one of those people that says, you know, I work at UHN, right. Put me to right. the front of your queue. But if somebody could have got a kidney in September, and this is happening in July, maybe I do want to put, you know, be a little push. Flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there wasn't an issue for that. So anyway, so I waited for my specialist appointment, had the appointment with Dr. Pasternak, and he was like, yeah, no, this isn't anything. And then of course, why didn't you just tell me? Why didn't you just call me? I'm like, because I didn't want to be special. So anyway, so here we are. So we're in the summer of 2023, and in November 2023, I had my all clear. And then I met with Dr. Cole. So Dr. Ed Cole did my sort of overall, you know, physician assessment with all of this knowledge now. And then I was told towards the end of December that yes, they would be submitting my sort of portfolio through to the matching process to start that donation, the donation exercise. And so I had the choice of being part of the paired donation where you're an anonymous donor with no specific recipient versus a directed donation. I'm not that, I'm this anonymous person. And so I could be part of the chain matching process where you don't have compatible pairs, but everyone's still willing. And we do this domino effect to make sure that everybody can link up and be part of a bigger chain, or I could donate to the deceased donor list where they're waiting, unfortunately, for someone to pass to receive the organ. But the nice part about the domino one, even though the intake is only twice a year, whereas the deceased donor is anytime, the domino one is that more people get organs, right? Because if you do it for him, I'll do it for her and she'll do it for them. And everybody gets something. And the last person to donate who has no one to give to gives to the deceased donor list. So there's always someone who will come off of that list, but many more upstream could potentially be served through this pairing process. So that exercise happens in January. Then they go through, I guess, everybody in my mind, I'm thinking everyone goes into this big hopper and there's all these computer things happening and this one matches, and they finally make this chain. I have no idea how long my chain of people was, but I know it was substantial enough that if I backed out, it would cause everything to crumble, because that's the thing. If someone steps out of the chain, it crumbles to the next logical point of agreement, right? And so I was not going to have that happen. And so I remember I was traveling in Kenora and I got the call from my coordinator and said, okay, we have a match for you. And so now we need to start the process. If you're not needing to back out, you're still feeling good about going forward, you're part of a chain and we'd like to start the process of truly going through scheduling surgery, et cetera. Wow. And so that was at the end of March, 2024. So now I'm at it a whole year, right? So it's basically been a year end to end. And for 4 weeks and a bit, we've gone through all of the pre-op work, all of the confirmation compatibility testing, all of the infectious disease testing to make sure there's no latent viruses. All of that stuff happened very quickly in 4 weeks. The OR was booked. You, as a anonymous donor, you have the agency to say, you know what, it's better for me to give during this period because I can unplug from work and manage my life a little bit better. It's not quite as critical. So I had a little bit of influence there, although I would have moved everything around, but I was able to kind of pick the week and we were able to schedule the OR. And Dr. Jason Lee did my surgery that morning and I was that Friday morning and I was out the following Monday. I was home in my bed on the Monday morning and I walked out of the hospital. I wasn't even on wheels. I walked to the parking garage and my ride took me home.
Wow. In movies, we think that people are out for months and months and they're very much like you said, and Loy and myself, they get you out of bed so quickly and you think, what? I can't get out of bed. I don't know if I can do this. And then, you can. Yeah, you can. Yeah. And you do it. And it's amazing. And what a process for you to go through to donate anonymously.
And it probably was, I mean, on the lab side of things, because so much is testing dependent when you're doing this, there's very little other health stuff to be done. It is very result reliant. I think it was an easier time for me because I completely understood what was going on behind the scenes, right? And if something didn't go well, I could troubleshoot it quickly if something was delayed or lost or whatever. I was able to navigate that nimbly, but then I also had, you know, some sober second thoughts when I'm sitting in waiting rooms or what have you. Like what would someone who didn't understand the process feel? How would they feel about having to recollect this sample because something went wrong in the background, which happens. It happens all the time. It's a manual process. Things happen. What could I do to make the parts that I can influence better? And so I was always thinking of, well, could we take less tubes? Because when you start some of the compatibility testing, as I'm confident you well know, in comes the bag of 20 or 30 Vacutainers and you're like, whoa, that is a lot of blood.
That's me. That's going to be me.
Yeah. I got to fill those and then some. Like, and you know, and in my heart of hearts, I know that it's actually not that much. When you donate a unit, it's not even half of a unit that you're giving, but it looks like a lot. And it think about the professional collecting the samples. It's a lot of work for them to keep that needle steady to make sure that the process is perfect end to end. Like, so can we do less of that? Can there be, you know, a heightened level of effort made, particularly around the urine collections, so that we consider them irretrievable samples, right? They're a bit something goes wrong with them, we just, it's urine, we'll get more.
Right.
Getting a 24-hour urine is not easy. And when this process, I had to do it 4 different times.
Oh my goodness.
A lot. I mean, it wasn't, everybody pees, right?
Yes.
Yes. Deal, but it's a big deal because you got to time it and haul it into work. And like, it's, can my program do to influence this process in a way that makes it not only easier for the patient, but also easier for the lab staff who are putting them through. And I mean, and at UHN, we're one of the biggest transplant centers that there is. So the volume of this work is significant, right? And the paperwork needs to be tight and it needs to be accurate. And what can the system do to make this really electronic and error proof? And so I took a lot of that away. At the end of the day, it wasn't as complicated as I thought it was going to be from a recovery and processing standpoint. Like once, I mean, the biggest thing for me that I liked the least was getting the IV out. That's the worst part, is the IV coming out, right? Like, okay,
wow.
If that was the worst part of this, I don't think there's much downside to giving up a kidney. Now, granted, I mean, I know my experience is my experience, and that there may be people who have maybe not had it an easier go of it, or where recovery was challenging, or there's a post-op infection, or maybe in the middle of the surgery when your physician got in, you couldn't, because I remember Dr. Lee very clearly saying, my accountability and priority is you and you being well. I will not compromise anything for the sake of facilitating a transplant.
Right.
If I get in there, because there's some things you're not going to know until you actually get in. If I get in and it doesn't look like it's going to be safe for you, you might wake up and learn you didn't give anybody anything, but that was my choice in the moment. And I'm doing it in your best interest. And so we had that conversation. And so I was not worried about any of it, really.
It's funny to listen to you because you have this amazing compassion for the patients that are part of our program.
But it's unique to be a patient and to be a professional in the system. Patient advocates are great. And they come from a place of, this is how it felt for me. And I didn't like that the meal was cold, and I wanted an option of juice and fruit. And I mean, although there's so many things that a patient is unhappy about, or they weren't treated properly. We asked their name and date of birth too many times. Yeah. And those are all things that we should be working at to make that patient experience better, nimble, safer, all that good stuff. To have the advocacy, but really informed advocacy is really, I can't imagine everyone within the hospital is equally potential to be a patient of some kind, and we're all going to feel it differently. But my natural instinct is to process engineer. And so sitting in every waiting room is like, all right, this armband, like how many these do we need?
Now, with a couple minutes left here, I've got two questions for you. We've talked a lot about your journey and thinking about the other side of things. So that recipient that's out there somewhere that's walking around with your kidney, if you could say something to them, what would you want to tell that recipient?
Yeah, a lot of people ask, like, so do you know who got it? I'm like, well, no. That's the whole anonymous part of the donation, right?
Yeah.
And I don't even know that I want to know who it is, right? I thought it was just so cool that somebody packed my kidney in a cooler and it got in a police car and it got sent somewhere. And we trust the system to send an organ somewhere and plug it into someone else. How cool is that?
Yeah.
And in my mind, it is a young girl somewhere in Ontario. For some reason, in my mind, I've manufactured this person. And I would want to know if they just feel better, right? I just want to know, how are you feeling now? I just want to know that they feel better. I don't want the validation or the gratitude. Like, I don't want the gratitude and all that kind of stuff. And if they feel better, then great. But what I would want to ask, because I'm an absolute workaholic, is, so as you were getting prepared to give, could the lab have done anything better for you? Because I want to fix that.
That's amazing. I love that.
I can do to make this easier for future use to go through this process. And I would say, like, I wish I could have got to you sooner. I wish that I told Dr. Pasternak to see me right away so I could get rid of the adrenal problem and hand it over to you sooner. I wish I'd filled in the package a year earlier. I wish I hadn't sat on that for 6 months now that I know what I know. It still makes for a nice story though. So maybe I wouldn't change it up too much.
I'm not able to speak for all recipients, but I can tell you that it was within a day that I absolutely felt like a completely different human being. Once I could actually wake up and know where I was and what was going on, it changed my life completely. And I've had my kidney for 15 years. And like Loy and I have talked about, you're able to do so much more now, and you're able to think about what you want to do with your future versus being uncertain. And so I hope you know that whatever the outcome from your recipient, that they are grateful and they're living a healthier life because of that decision that you made. Lastly, if there was something you could tell the public that you would want the public to know about living donation, what would you say?
People don't do it because they are worried that they need it for themselves or for their family. That is an absolutely appropriate and okay thing to feel, and no one should feel a lick of guilt about that. And I thought about it and I evaluated my flock to say, okay, let's say any of you need a kidney in the rest of my lifetime, do we have a plan B in the herd, right? Like I looked at my whole herd and said, do we got a plan? Because I'd like to do this. And we had a plan. So I did think about it too. And what if nothing happens and we all end our lives on this mortal coil with two full kidneys that someone could have used? So how about we just think about things that way, and let's just roll the dice and let the healthcare system do the right thing. And if we find ourselves on the wrong side of this choice, the healthcare system is still going to look after us, right? So I think if you're on this fence where you're not really sure if you should, and you're worried about what happens if, the very system that's making it easy for you to give will look after you when and if you find yourself in a position of needing it, the other end of the support. And so I just would reinforce that. I mean, it's everybody's choice, absolutely. But if you're interested and you want to explore it, I would get into the pipeline knowing that you can get out if suddenly it doesn't seem a fit for you, but don't choose to not follow the process because of something that might happen. So I would just offer that up.
Thank you so much for your time today, Christine, and for everything you and your team do behind the scenes that not everybody knows about. And especially, of course, for that incredible gift of life that you gave.
My total pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me today. It was a real gift to be able to share.
Thank you so much. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please leave us a review and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you are listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, you can reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca or on social at givelifeuhn. For more information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Lead Podcasting for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.